Welcome to episode 2 of Human Nature, Buddha Nature, with me, Reverend Casperita. Everyone calls me Casper. Today, I'm talking about one of the big singing bowls that we have in the shrine room and why we ring it. That was recorded on location in the shrine room at Bright Earth. We've got a teaching from Satya on small miracles. And then a culture moment where I'm talking about Caitlin Doherty's book from 2015, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. So let's begin by going over to the shrine room at Bright Earth Buddhist Temple. So I'm here in the shrine room. It's just after practice on Saturday morning. We've just come into the second half of August and it's very hot. Maybe you can hear the voices of some of the congregation in the background behind me in the other room. But I'm here because I want to talk about one of the objects in the shrine room. Today, I'm going to talk about a big singing bowl that we ring once at the start of practice. It's probably a Nepalese or Tibetan singing bowl. It's about a foot in diameter. Produces a beautiful noise. I can't remember where it came from. Most of the objects in the shrine room, I could tell you who bought them or who donated them. I have a feeling my old teacher might have bought this and offered it to the temple. But I can't quite remember. I could have checked that before doing this recording. We often have school visits coming to the temple, classes of children, and when I used to do them years ago, when they were all sort of unsettled at the beginning of the visit, I would tell them I was going to ring this bell and ask them to count how many seconds the sound went on for. And it goes on for a long time. And by the end, the children are settled because they've been listening to this sound that gets quieter and quieter and quieter. Let me ring it now. And it goes on and on and on. And we ring it once at the start of practice. It's our version of a cleansing the space bell, which is a tradition in Buddhist sanctuaries, in Buddhist shrine rooms, before the ritual to cleanse the space somehow, partly to get rid of any bad spirits or dark energy. And you know, I'm very ambivalent about the idea of spirits existing. Sometimes it makes sense to me, sometimes it doesn't make sense to me, but I am fascinated by it, and it's good to follow your curiosity. I also think it's good to know where these traditions come from, how people in the past made sense of them, and think about how we can make sense of them today. You know, people do experience things. People all over the world experience things that they recognize as not belonging to the material world. Are they products of our own psyches? Are they actually something coming from outside? I don't know. Some of them feel very wholesome. Some of them feel more negative. When I was at university, when was that? More than 20 years ago. You know, I had a lot of good times at university, but I struggled a lot with my mental health as well. And one night, in my little room, I woke up. Everything was quiet. And there were two figures, two pale, luminescent, almost translucent figures at the end of the bed. One was standing and one was sitting on a ghost chair. And I had such a sense of their compassion and care. It felt like a really lovely thing to be watched over by these two figures. And I rolled over and went back to sleep. And I felt deeply reassured by this experience. It stayed with me for a while. It sort of really soothed me and settled something in me. Of course, in the morning, I wondered if it had been a dream. Even if it was a dream, it was still very reassuring. It didn't feel like it was something of my creation, just a sign that there is something good here. There's something good that's looking out for you. And it was really lovely. In the night, I was convinced that I'd woken up. The next day, I was convinced it was a dream. Later, I look back on it and I don't know. But it was a real experience that I had. So the cleansing bell, ringing a bell as a way of cleansing the shrine. I introduced this ritual to this temple after reading Zenju Earthling Manuel, the Zen teacher, Zenju Earthling Manuel, writing about her experience of it in her book, The Shamanic Bones of Zen. So let me read you what she writes. It is dark, early morning, while aspirants are still sleeping. I slip downstairs to perform the ritual before ringing the wake-up bell. I bow to the Han, a wooden drum hanging on a rope. One beats with the mallet. I bow again. I go down a few stairs and bow to a handbell sitting on a small shelf. I carry it with me into the dark zendo. Both hands are wrapped around the bell's handle at the center of my body, near my heart. I walk and bow to the altar upon which sits Manjushri, the god of wisdom, who cuts through darkness. I ring the bell in a cascading motion, up and down three times. I bow again, step to the left, and walk to the nearest corner. I ring the bell in that corner. I go to the next corner and ring the bell. I go to the next and the next. I am waking up the spirits of the sanctuary, letting the ancestors know we are coming. I am clearing the energy of the space where the ritual of Zazen will take place. I bow again at the altar and ring the bell three times in a cascading rhythm as it has been done for centuries. She goes on to say, in every ceremony, the pace, the place, land, circle, home or temple must be cleansed before the people enter. It's important that the people are also cleansed before participating in the healing ritual. This cleansing may be washing of the feet and hands before entering the sanctuary. I've witnessed the cleansing of the land with those who practice the Lakota way. They place burning coals in a large can and add the needles of a cedar tree to induce the fragrance of the earth. Those selected to do the cleansing use smoke first to cleanse themselves and pray. Then, lightly swinging their cans with the smoke, the selected walk the ceremonial land, much like how Catholic priests smoke the cathedral by swinging a cauldron of incense. Instead of swinging a pot of smoke in the Zen center, a bell, much like a Christmas bell, is rung in a cascading rhythm to energetically clear the space for Zazen. In each case, the spiritual act of cleansing is done to rid the ritual space of unseen things that might interrupt the ceremony. So, Zenju Earthling Manuel says, participating in the healing ritual, I would say all rituals in Buddhism are healing rituals. I think she would agree, actually. She also says, you know, in that description, which is the way it's been done in Zen temples for hundreds and hundreds of years, the bell is rung to clear the space before participants enter. Somehow participants cleanse themselves or make themselves ready to come into the space before they enter. It's partly why we bow when we come into the shrine room. And in Zen temples, you're invited to step through the doorway with your left foot. It invites a moment of pause before coming into the room, a moment to become more still and focused. We actually ring this singing bowl, inspired by this story, after people have entered into the shrine room. But there are things that happen in here before people come in. The shrine room is cleaned, the altars are cleaned, new flowers are put out. The water offerings are removed from the shrine and given to the earth, emptied, ready to be filled again during the practice session. The candles are lit, incense is placed out. All of these things contribute to the atmosphere in the shrine room. We, here in the Bright Earth Temple, we're trying to find a balance of respecting tradition and also respecting how difficult it can be for modern people to enter into strange rituals. These rituals have a power, and I really, regardless of the sense we make of them, entering into a ritual space can change us somehow. It creates new states of mind. It makes healing more likely, psychological, spiritual healing. And yet the barrier to entering a space with a lot of ritual can be quite high for people. So we're really a kind of an ongoing negotiation between those two things. It's also worth saying that years ago, a Shin Buddhist minister — Shin Buddhism is the largest school of Pure Land Buddhism in Japan, following the teachings of Shinran, who were a teacher who we're also very inspired by here in Bright Earth — said to me that Shin Buddhism is not superstitious. So in Japan, there's lots of what he would have described as superstitious practices within Buddhism. If you go to temples in Japan, you can buy good luck charms, amulets for helping you with your job interview, to get the good exam results, for the birth of a healthy child. These are things people make prayers for at Buddhist temples and buy offerings for and give offerings to the temple in order to receive good things. Superstition, I guess he was talking about changing, using magic, using spiritual practices to change worldly conditions. And from the Shin Buddhist point of view, and doctrinally, he's right. This is, you know, this is how it is. We don't need to do any of that. We just say the Nembutsu, we do our Buddhist practice, trusting that we will receive enlightenment or remember enlightenment, and that's enough. Once we're close to the Buddha, once we have a taste of enlightenment, the more taste of enlightenment we have, the more enlightened we are, the less we need to worry about those worldly things. So why engage with them at all? Maybe that's where the non-superstitious view comes from. And yet, we do still have to navigate the world, right? And Buddhist practice helps us navigate the material world in all sorts of ways. It helps me, anyway. And Buddhist lay people, they still make prayers for all these sorts of things. They still use their Buddhist practice in other ways to help them navigate the world, to create calm before going into a stressful meeting. You know, following the precepts because they know that brings a calmer mind. It's easier to live life when you follow the precepts, or all sorts of different things. So Buddhist practice for ordinary people, for everybody really, has these two halves. How do we move closer to enlightenment? And how do we deal with the world? And one of the ways that Buddhist lay people deal with the world in traditional Buddhist countries, can be very alien to modern minds, is to pray to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to make these offerings, to wish for good things in their life. And also to practice working with spirits, with the with ancestors in a positive way, and with hungry ghosts. Very long tradition in Buddhism of working with spirits who are in the realm of hungry ghosts. So the idea here is that after death, somebody is reborn into this realm of hungry ghosts, where beings have insatiable appetites and very small throats. They're never satisfied, they're restless, they can't get anything they want. It's a place of suffering. And we have these rituals to help ease the suffering of those beings. This all started with the Buddha 2,500 years ago giving advice to one of his close disciples, Moggallana. Moggallana had a dream or a vision of his mother, who had passed recently, suffering in this realm of hungry ghosts. And he asked the Buddha, what should I do? My mother's suffering in this way. And the Buddha said, she can't receive any Dharma. That's why she's been reborn there. But she can still receive something. So offer her what she can receive. Not Dharma, but something good. And it's that principle that the hungry ghost ceremony is based upon. In fact, Moggallana slipped up and it said that he entered that world, he went into that hell realm, he went into the realm of hungry ghosts. He released all of these hungry ghosts into the world. And then they had to have this big ceremony where they offered food, they made food offerings, which the hungry ghosts were happy to receive. They couldn't receive the teachings of the Buddha, but they could be taken care of. And they settled down. And they went on to have higher rebirths in the future. And to this day, a hungry ghost ceremony in Buddhism. We offer food to the hungry ghosts. Let me read you what Kyogen Carson said about it. This is a talk that was edited into an article in Tricycle a few years ago, in fall 2021 edition of Tricycle. The tradition is continued every year in Buddhist temples by making an offering on a table far away from any statue or picture of the Buddha or Bodhisattva. For those who reject religious teaching, the hungry ghosts, kindness is offered without doctrine, the truest form of generosity. During Sagaki, we put donuts on the altar. The hungry ghosts can't accept the Dharma. They choke on it. A lot of people are that way. You try to give them religion and their throat just constricts, so you give them a donut. The profundity of that Dharma is amazing. Just give something. For an offering to be genuinely one of Dharma, it must be given in forms that can be accepted. This principle applies to so many situations we encounter in everyday life. Such an action naturally expresses all acceptance in a way that touches and deeply affects all concerned. Sagaki is a time of deep spiritual renewal. Here, the main Sagaki ceremony features an altar laden with food. The ceremony involves an invitation to all ghosts of every stripe, anywhere, to come join us. During the chanting and procession, we offer incense, and the names of people who have died in the past year are read aloud. After the ceremony, we help the Gakis by eating the food on the altar ourselves. Next, a couple of teenagers dress up as hungry ghosts and visit the Dharma school children, grabbing food and walking around with their shoes on. This annual visit always brings joy and a bit of apprehension to the little ones, who must teach the ill-mannered Gakis the way to behave in a temple, and a little of the Dharma, if possible. The closing ceremony, Sagaki Toro, is done in the evening. It is an intense symbolic ritual of cleansing. During the ceremony, a fire is lit in the fireplace. Slips of paper with the names of people who have died in the past year, along with the year's transfer of merit cards, are fed to the fire. Anyone who wishes to can write down some karma or problem that they wish to let go of or cleanse, and one by one they put the slips of paper on the fire themselves. So it's really common in Buddhist countries to have this awareness of the non-material world, that there is something going on that we can't measure with our scientific instruments and scientific minds. You know, maybe we can look at it this way. The psyche is pretty permeable. The psyche, what the Buddha calls the heart mind, is pretty permeable. We take in all sorts of ideas and beliefs from outside of us all the time. Some of these are systems of oppression that we internalize: misogyny, racism, transphobia, anything that supports the idea that we should have power over another group or think less of them somehow. We take in and internalize ideas like capitalism, for example. We may have beliefs in our family structure: don't air the dirty laundry in public, whatever it is. All of these things sort of sink their way into us, and they're not really to do with who we are, but we carry them with us. We carry the ghosts of our ancestors with us in our genes, in our memories, in the beliefs that have been passed down through family lines, some positive, some negative. Whether you believe in spirits or not, I think it's easy to believe in those kind of ghosts, the way that we're haunted by these ideas and rituals, like the hungry ghost ceremony, like any Buddhist practice, even just meditation, are a way of letting go of these things, of clearing up the things that we don't need out of our system. And the bell is an ancient way of doing that. Now, of course, traditionally, the bell is rung before anybody is in the shrine room, because the ancient view was that there really were spirits, there really was some energy that needed cleansing. And sometimes I believe that and sometimes I don't, but I still think there's a value in ringing the bell. I definitely should have rung the bell again right at the end. What a missed opportunity. I didn't think of it until I was in the car on the way home. On October the 31st, Halloween, as you might know it, we're going to have a hungry ghost ceremony in our usual Saturday morning practice slot. So you're welcome to join us in person at the temple or online for that. We won't have any teenagers walking around with shoes on in the shrine room, but we will make food offerings and be remembering our ancestors. Now it's time for Satya's offering. Reverend Satyavani, like me, one of the founding ministers of Bright Earth Buddhist Temple, and also, as it happens, my wife. We've been married for 15 years, so I took advantage of us living in the same house and got her to record something. This is a piece on small miracles that appeared a few years ago in Buddhist Door magazine. A couple of words that you might need to know if you're not familiar with Pure Land Buddhism. Bombu means a foolish being, which is to say an ordinary human that is flawed and makes mistakes and is not perfected, that we still have greed and ill will and ignorance in our hearts. And you know, that's true for me. So that's what a Bombu being is. And Amitabha is the Buddha of infinite light, not a historical Buddha, no one that lived on our world in time, but a mythological Buddha or a symbol for the energy of enlightenment that is still present in this world, that we can tune into, that we can invoke or remember. Sometimes Buddhists think of that energy as being deep inside their own hearts, that we're remembering its presence there. sometimes we're remembering that it's all around us and that we can just lean into it. And in that entrusting, we become closer to enlightenment ourselves. So that's Bombu, foolish being, and Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light.
Finding radiance in difficult times. As your mind becomes pure and clear, its uttermost purification causes you to see suddenly the great earth, mountains and rivers in the 10 directions change into the Buddha's pure land, adorned with all kinds of precious gems, whose radiance is all-pervading. Surangama Sutra 8.8. This summer has been tough. The drought, the heat, the climate and ecological emergency is moving from the background of people's minds into the foreground. Alongside all this, we are faced with the usual little dukkhas that being alive brings. I used to underestimate the effect of these small to medium-sized niggles, a worry that we said the wrong thing to our friend last night, having to clear up a smashed mug, the supermarket running out of the ice cream we were really looking forward to. I now see these micro-challenges as a big part of what wears us down. It's not always the major crises that finish us off, but the seventh time we have to ask our dog to stop scratching our favourite armchair. Pure Land Buddhism helps me with this experience of being a struggling human. It tells me that we are all Bombu beings, often helplessly bobbing along on the currents of our greed, hate and delusion, all our best attempts at keeping our system steady. It tells me that there is support available and that we receive it not when we work really hard or become perfect, but when we surrender and call out for help. It also reminds me that the Buddha's Pure Land is available to us right here in this world, and not just as a comforting destination when we die. What does it mean that when our mind is pure and clear, suddenly the great earth, mountains and rivers in the 10 directions change into the Buddha's Pure Land? This morning I walked slowly around the temple garden, making some space for myself before my busy day. I noticed spears of daffodils peppering the lawn, the first hint of the sun to come, and watched a fat thrush poking around for worms. The blue patches of sky above me opened up, expanding, and became luminous. When we look through the right eyes, the beauty of the earth steps towards us. Whether in a cityscape or a field, whether in driving rain or sparkling cold, we become open to the radiance of the gems around us and we are nourished by their light. Despite the weight of our everyday concerns, we find a little wiggle room, a place where we can take a breath before carrying on. If the Pure Land is always available to us, then the million-dollar question is how we might obtain a pure and clear mind in order to see it. I think that there are a few different ways of answering this question. The first is the traditionally Buddhist way, through practice. If we can sit quietly and let our busy thoughts settle, we are more likely to find this clarity. It will also help if we put effort into doing the right things, looking after our physical health, asking for emotional support when we need it, trying to follow the precepts, and helping others. This self-power approach is championed in the West, and there are lots of cultural beliefs that support it. Poor people should just work harder, the American dream, and so on. The second is a more traditionally Pure Land approach. It's great to put effort into doing the right things, but we accept that we are not always capable of following through. Yes, my body would appreciate it if I did 15 minutes of yoga most mornings, but I haven't been capable of that for months. Yes, I might have a clearer mind if I did more Buddhist practice, but today I'm deciding to watch an hour of trashy television instead. We accept that we are bamboo, we acknowledge our helplessness, and we turn to Amitabha Buddha for help. This is not always a popular suggestion. I clung to my illusion of self-mastery and control for decades, preferring to believe I just wasn't trying hard enough than the alternative of really seeing my limits and the limits of the world. Also, it can be a great relief to finally acknowledge our frailties, as those who have completed step one of the 12-step programs will know. When we can admit to our powerless over our addictions or our fears, we begin to open ourselves up to the great wisdom and deep compassion of all the Buddhas. Pure lands suddenly appear. What's wonderful about this other power wisdom, it's that we hand the purification of our minds over to the Buddhas as well. We stop seeing ourselves as the director of the whole show and instead find our small part and play it to the best of our ability. We put down the enormous and impossible responsibility of self-perfection and receive the gift of helping hands. We begin to believe that we might be able to muddle along in this flawed and astonishing world, appreciating the jewels as we go. During difficult times, we have an extra opportunity to see how small and weak we really are. Paradoxically, when we stop trying to control the universe and allow the universe to show us what we need to do, we are capable of performing miracles. Mostly tiny miracles, as we move a snail to the side of the path where it won't get squished, or we offer a listening ear to our lonely elderly neighbour. A million miracles nonetheless, a million precious gems that adorn the world.
Well, it's time for another, not a pop culture moment. Last time I talked about a film from decades ago, was it the 60s, Jason and the Argonauts was from? Today I want to talk about a book that was written in 2015, so only 11 years ago, but that I just started reading. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Caitlin Doughty, which is stories of her time working in a crematorium and coming to terms with the fact that we all die. It's very well written. I don't think I've seen a dead body. I'd remember, right, if I'd seen a dead body. I don't think I've seen one. I've been with people who are dying in my work as a hospital chaplain many years ago, for example. But in the UK, funerals tend to be closed casket. And that's pretty unusual in the whole of human history. Mostly, we would have seen a dead body. We'd have had time to think about what that meant. And it's a bit hidden now. I mean, there's much more awareness of it than there was when I was growing up. It's a much less taboo subject in the modern world, but it's still pretty taboo. So this was really refreshing. And you know, one of the big things in Buddhism is coming to terms with impermanence, and particularly the impermanence of ourselves, our bodies, people that we love. So I'm really enjoying it and getting a lot out of it. I want to read you a paragraph. So this is in a chapter where she's describing her experience working with the cremation machine. And at a certain point, you have to pull the remains out of the machine with a rake. And then they go into another much, much smaller machine to grind them up if there's any pieces of bone left. And then it's that powder that is given to the mourners. So the mourners also aren't involved in this process of cremation, which is also pretty unusual in the whole of human
history right, we would have had families, loved ones, even priests would have been involved in the process of burial, in the process of cremation. So in this chapter, she writes, not every culture prefers to avoid the bones. In the first century AD, the Romans built tall cremation pyres from pine logs. The uncoffined corpse was laid atop the pyre and set ablaze. After the cremation ended, the mourners collected the bones, hand-washed them in milk, and placed them in urns. Lest you think bone washing hails only from the ancient Bacchanalian past, bones also play a role in the death rituals of contemporary Japan. During Kotsuage, the gathering of the bones, the mourners gather around the cremation machine. When the bones are pulled out of the chamber, the bones are laid on a table, and the family members come forward with long chopsticks to pick them up and transfer them into the urn. The family first plucks the bones of the feet, working the way up towards the head so that the deceased person can walk into eternity upright. It makes me think of two things. One is how when the Buddha died, he gave instructions that his bones should be divided among different communities and that those fragments should be interned in stupas, mounds, like hemispherical mounds, if you like, that lay people would go to remember the Buddha. And this is still a Buddhist practice today, going and walking around a stupa in memory of the Buddha. And remembering the Buddha is one of the central practices at Bright Earth, bringing the spirit with which the Buddha lived his life into the present moment. Those stupas spread across Buddhist countries. Obviously, the number of bones didn't multiply, but the structure of the stupa did as a place of memorial. And then the pavilions that you get in China and Japan, those are the descendants of the original mounds with the Buddha's remains in. But it also reminded me of earlier this year, Satya and I and Satya's family went to scatter the ashes of Satya's father, who died a few years ago. And as we were doing that, Satya reached into the ashes with her ungloved hand and took a handful and scattered them, and then offered the rest of us the chance to do the same. And in that moment, I thought, oh, that's weird. I've never seen anyone doing that before. And yet the more I thought about it, the more I appreciated that gesture, the kind of unconscious care that it demonstrated. There was something very meaningful in that making of physical contact with the remains. I think there is something that we're missing here in the modern world, when we don't allow ourselves to have those moments. Many years ago, I heard about a temple in Thailand where they had an embalmed corpse that was slowly decomposing, and school visits would come and view it. This very profound encounter with the impermanence of the body. I'm not necessarily suggesting we do that here, but I think there is space for more awareness of both the dying process and the process of decomposition, of breaking apart that bodies go through after death, returning to the earth. It's very powerful, and yeah, I think we could do with a bit more of that. So if you haven't read it, and you might have done, because the book's 11 years old, right? It's a strong recommend from me, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Caitlin Doughty. Thanks for joining us for episode 2. We really appreciate your attention. Thanks to Satya for sharing her teaching. Satya and I have both got talks coming up in person and online, check out the Bright Earth website at brightearth.org for details of those. You can find recordings of past talks from both of us and other ministers on that website as well, and particularly on our YouTube channel. Just search for Bright Earth Buddhism. You're welcome to join us for practice online or in person as well. Again, all the details are on the website. I guess maybe I should have some regular way of signing off, but for now, I'll just say thank you.